Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Firehouse Management Podcast. We're at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, at a live podcast recording. I'm Rich Gassaway. I'm the Fire Chief of Roseville, Minnesota, and the host of the Leaders Toolbox podcast program on firehouse.com. Today we have a distinguished panel of three guests that will be addressing questions on firehouse management, and I'd like to give them an opportunity to introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about their background before we get into the first question. Mark?
Oh, thank you. My name is Mark Emery. I'm a battalion chief in King County, Washington. I work in a four-station fire district called Woodinville Fire and Life Safety District. We're a career fire department, CFAI accredited, and I'm fourth-generation career firefighter. My dad, granddad, great-granddad all retired from Long Beach, California Fire Department, and so I was a black sheep that moved north and got out of Long Beach and settled in near Seattle in King County, Washington. But it's an honor to be here, especially with this panel. It's a real pleasure for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. John?
Hello, my name is John Salka. I'm a battalion chief in the Bronx with the FDNY, and I do some writing and lecturing and teaching here for Firehouse and for Firehouse Magazine.
Thanks, John. Dennis?
Good afternoon. My name is Dennis Compton. I spent 27 years in the Phoenix, Arizona Fire Department. Retired from there as assistant fire chief. Then went over to Mesa, Arizona, which is a city of about 500,000 people east of Phoenix, and I was the fire chief there for 6 years, and I'm currently the chairman of the board of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation.
Okay. Thanks to all three of you for attending and participating. As you give your answers, at the beginning of your answer, maybe identify yourself so that the listeners on the radio podcast will know which of the chiefs that is giving them the response, and that'll help them to sort out who's who. From the audience, at any time that anyone has a question, please feel free to come up and have a seat at the front chair, and you can we'll call on you to bring your question forth for the panel. First question we're going to start with came from a listener who sent it in through firehouse.com. It's, how does personal leadership relate to a fire officer's credibility and their ability to lead others? And I'll open it up to the panel for whoever wants to go first.
I'll be happy to go first with that. We spend a lot of time, I think, and rightfully so, in our leadership training talking about leading other people. And it's the first thing that comes to your mind, in fact, when someone even mentions the term leadership. But we all know that you lead primarily by example. In other words, people are watching us, and I think they take the lead from us as to how we expect them to behave and perform in their roles. This is an interesting question because it gets to the issue of personal leadership. At least I have a strong belief that part of our responsibility as a leader is to help people be positive, productive, and healthy in their work. In other words, that's really what we're trying to accomplish, so that they can perform the mission of the organization. I really believe that that's our primary responsibility. If we can't do that for ourselves, I don't know how you can do that for other people if it's true that you lead primarily by example. In other words, if we can't keep ourselves positive, productive, and healthy examples in our fire departments, then I just have a difficult time thinking that we could instill those in other people. So I think it's very important. In fact, if you can't do that for yourself, yet you expect that from other people, it's almost do as I say, not as I do. And there's not anything that affects your credibility more than that. So I would say it's an important part of leadership. It's just as important as the concepts of leading others.
This is John Salka. Yes, I agree with you, Dennis, and I'm sure everybody out in the audience, everybody that's listening, agrees as well. the idea that you could that you can't manage yourself and you don't have any leadership, personal leadership skills, and then that you could somehow, when you put your uniform on, go to work, be a better example and motivate people to do a great job is pretty hollow, you know, from any perspective. There are some people out there that say we lead from the front or we lead from behind, and but everybody leads from the front. That's where leadership is. It's out front, and sometimes it's physically out front, and sometimes it's not. Some great leaders that I know have generated and produced excellent leaders in their organization, people that are great followers and learners and eventually start leading. And even when the leader is not there, these people are performing, but he is there. You know, he's there up in the forefront of those folks' minds when they're doing something, when they're taking great actions or when they're, you know, doing something in the firehouse, conducting some positive aspect of their leadership skills. They're thinking about where they learned those skills from. They're thinking about the examples that have been set for them. And again, as Dennis said, and I have to reiterate, I agree with that. We all lead by example. That's how we motivate most of the people, by the example that we set. And I tell guys that all the time, both in my leadership classes and in the firehouse and on the training ground, that how you look, how you act, how you talk to people, how you address civilians, how you speak to the chief on the phone, how you dress in the firehouse, all of those things are measuring sticks for your leadership skills and abilities, and everybody is not going to just be a puppet of you or you know mimic your every action, but those are great ways to influence people in a positive way, and you should pay attention to all of that. All of us have been firemen. Everybody who's an officer or a chief and who's in a leadership role, everybody who's an entry level firefighter, and I always remember watching the bosses and listening to the bosses how important that was to me, what they were saying and what they were doing.
Mark Emery. I you can't really add much to that, but I personally believe that one of the keys is that people is an understanding right off the bat and really believing that people don't work for you, they work with you. If you have the attitude in the fire station or in life or wherever you are that people work for you, your people won't like that. But if they know they're working with you, that you're willing to help them do things, they'll help you do things. And that's leading by example. That's that they brought up, and I think everybody would agree with that. That to me is one of the most important components.
Follow up on that. Do you guys think that it's possible for somebody to separate their off-the-job behavior from their on-the-job behavior, or do you think that their employees judge them equally as to how they behave when they're at work versus how they might behave in their private life? Is there a distinction, or do you think that you're always being judged?
This is John Salk again. You know what? Behavior is really just a reflection of your values and who you are. It's not a matter of what channel you're turning on. You're on channel 2 when you're at home, and you're on channel 3 when you're at work. You know, if you're trustworthy and you have integrity and you work hard, and you, then that's how you are all the time. I don't think it's a turn-on, turn-off type of a thing. So it's not a matter of you have different behavior. I imagine there are some people that maybe vary their behavior a little bit from on-duty, off-duty. I know some guys that are a lot of fun and smile a lot and kid around when they're home, but when they're at work, it's all business. They're a little bit more reserved, but the values are still the same. The things that are important to them are still the same, whether they're home or at work. And I think actually that turns out to be a pretty good reflection. I mean, we look at these governors and presidents and people with, you know, liaisons and doing illegal things in public life. That's who they are, and that ends up being reflected in the way that they run the office as well as the way that they do things at home or in their private life. So I don't think it's really a – I don't think there's anything there to be different. I think it's a pretty constant situation.
I think it's easy – this is Mark Emery. I think it's easy to identify in the fire service, too, when somebody's pretending to be a leader. And I just did a class where we talked about poise and confidence, that a true leader has poise and confidence, whether somebody's looking or not. And where you really excel, where you really find out who the true person is and the true leader, is under stress. That's where you really find out if the leader really has that genuine poise and confidence under stress and can be able to not only control themselves, have self-control, but have the trust of their people that poise and confidence and leadership is genuine before the stressful moment happens. And that's where they'll follow you, because they have that trust that you've developed with, and they know you have that poise and confidence.
And this is Dennis Compton. I agree. I think that you're one package. And I think, too, that if you look at the fire service in general, we don't have two lives. I mean, we tend to hang out, in fact, with the very people we work with fairly often. And I think that in a leadership position, you're always being evaluated. I mean, the people we lead, they know the difference between chicken salad and chicken something else, just like we do. And I think it's very obvious when someone is pretending to be something they're not. I think that has an impact on your ability to move people in a particular direction. And I would add that not all leadership is positive. In other words, I've seen people who were pretty strong personalities and leaders lead others in a direction that was not in their best interest. So I think that, I think it's one package. I don't think you can separate them.
I would add one thing, Mark Emery, again, that there's a lot of leaders in history that have not been very good people. And they were very strong, powerful leaders that even led countries that I don't think anybody wants to model that particular leadership behavior or skill set. But they were still leaders. And they were genuine, but it was leadership for something that was not good. It was really leadership for the led countries into evil. Hitler would be an example.
Again, yes, John Salka, again, I'd like to add one more thing about what Dennis just said. And again, I agree. I guess we agree a lot, Dennis. There's one package, and that's who everybody is. You're the same guy whether you're working, whether you're off duty, whether you're this, whether you're that. And as far as... you hear people talking about a good boss. You hear, young firefighters or young officers talking about a chief, let's say, for example, or young firefighters talking about a company officer saying, I would follow that guy anywhere. Anybody ever heard somebody say that? I would follow that guy or I would follow that gal anywhere. That's like the ultimate compliment for a leader. That means you display those real genuine traits that people can recognize, that you're confident and you're able to handle emergency situations and unexpected happenings, and they would follow you anywhere. That's a one-line statement that pretty much puts it all into one capsule. The other thing is, when it comes down to who we are, firefighting is our career and our job, although there are lots of folks that are volunteer firefighters too, but we don't work for the fire department. If you ask a guy, what do you do? I've never heard a firefighter say, I work for the fire department. What do they say? I'm a fireman. It's not what we do. It's who we are. So there really is a very blurred line between, being home off duty in your jeans with your kids in the pool, or being, back at the firehouse with the uniform on with the folks that work there.
This is Dennis Compton. One thing I would add to that is that you... you have such an influence on people's careers if you're in a formal position of leadership, and even if it's some other informal role that you play, but it's such an impact on their careers. We were talking in the session this morning, is that working for some people can be the best thing that ever happened in a person's career. The opportunity to work for somebody, a particular leader, can be the best thing that ever happened in somebody's career. But I've seen situations where the opportunity to work for certain leaders was the worst thing that ever happened in a young person's career. And I think that's a decision that you all get to make, the audience gets to make. No one makes that one for you. In other words, do you want to be an example of a leader where someone says that about you? It's the best opportunity I ever had in my career was to work for you. Or do you want to be the one that people say later on, the worst thing that ever happened to me was getting assigned to that person?
Building on that, Denny, I think that some people think that working for a boss that's easy on you is the best experience. But I think that, reflecting back on my career, the best experiences I've had are the bosses who were the toughest on me. And they were tougher on me than maybe they were on others. And at the time, I don't know that I really understood. Maybe I thought I was being picked on or singled out, because it seemed like they always held a higher expectation for me than they held for other people that I was working with. And I had this come to light to me when I was having a conversation with one of my bosses along the way, who was treating me what I thought was particularly unfair. And he explained to me that he treats me that way because he has a higher expectation of me than he had of them. And he knew that I was capable of giving more than what they were, and he was pushing me to be my best. And when he put it in that perspective, it made me want to work even harder for him. But I come to realize that the bosses who were hardest on me were actually among the best bosses that I'd had along my way, because they really did push me to be my best. Okay, we're going to take a second question. This one also comes from a podcast listener through firehouse.com. How does entry-level selection influence the long-term leadership of a fire department? How does entry-level selection influence the long-term leadership of a fire department?
Well, this Dennis Compton. Go ahead, Mark.
This is Mark again. I think because those people are going to become the leaders of the fire department. So I think maybe what you got to do is pick people that are leaders when they come in.
This is Dennis Compton. John mentioned a few minutes ago the term values in leadership. And this question, I think, relates directly to that. Is that there are a lot of organizations, not just fire departments, who have really looked at the issue of adding value assessment to people who they're getting ready to hire. So they're not just looking at what would be standard criteria, but based on references, what are those people's values? And I think that if we hire people into a service organization, which a fire department is, whose forehead ought to be stamped not fit for human contact, and then we sick them on the public, and then we have service delivery problems, that's called a hiring error. It truly is. And if we hire that type of an issue, that type of problem at the entry level, we need to ask ourselves, how long do they typically stay? In other words, how long do you own that problem? And is that person likely to promote to supervisory positions during their career? And if they do, will they influence the young and influence others in the organization? And I think it's hard to look at that one as just an isolated question, because that has a lot of moving parts to it.
I agree. And the when it comes to hiring, when it comes to entry-level people and who you hire and how you hire, and this comes right down to volunteer fire departments. For those of you that are volunteers, I started as a volunteer 5,000 years ago or something, but I remember joining the first volunteer fire department in my hometown. It was it was the black ball system. You came in and you got introduced to some people, and you had to have a sponsor. Somebody had to know you, which means they were putting their reputation on the line for you, and the black balls went in a basket. If there was one, you were not in. They kissed you goodbye and sent you back, and you went somewhere else. Now, I'm not suggesting that's a valid way of doing it, but it was a system, and there still was a system there. Maybe just one person in a room knew something bad about you. Maybe you shoplifted something from their store 9 years earlier when you were a 12-year-old kid or something. But the point is, whether it's you coming into the volunteer fire department, whether it's you getting hired into a small career department or a combination department or a larger career department that has a civil service system. I always love talking about my buddy Rick Lasky. Rick's a great guy. He's a chief down in Lewisville, Texas. And, you know, they hire their own firefighters like everybody else does. And it's quite a intricate system where they bring people in, and it's not just a test. It's not just knowledge. But there are interviews and there are questions about personal life. And this really brings us back to the last question again, right back to values and being a leader. You're the same guy when you're coming on the job as a young firefighter that you're going to be 5 years later or 7 years later or 10 years later when you become a young lieutenant. Yeah, your skills are going to change and your attitudes possibly are going to, you know, be molded as time goes on. But I think whatever you have in you when you're an 18-year-old man or 18-year-old woman and you're applying for a job somewhere, probably some of the same strong bedrock values that you have 10, 20, 30 years later. So opening up the door to good quality people at entry level is the thing that's going to assure a good quality organization down the road as well, for sure.
Something parallel to values, I never thought about that, about the values thing. That was kind of a revelation for me. But parallel to that, what about attitude? What if we aggressively looked for good attitudes? That the number one criteria for hiring a firefighter in your fire department, just think, if you'd been doing this for 50 years in your fire department, that the first thing you look for is hiring a good attitude, and then you figure out how to train that attitude, how to take a hydrant and tie a bowline knot. So you don't end up with somebody that can take a hydrant great and tie a bowline knot blindfolded, but you end up with a 30-year bad attitude. I think we should hire for attitude, number one. And now I would add to that, which I've always believed is values. I think that's really good.
Yeah, and this is John Salk again. I have a phrase that I use in one of my leadership classes, and it says, leaders with great passion and no skills always outperform leaders with great skills and no passion. We can teach you the skills, but the passion is the gold nugget, you know, and passion like values and some of these other aspects that we talked about. That's the important stuff.
This Dennis Compton, and that relates directly back to the issue of leading other people. Because if you bring the right people into your organization in the first place, in other words, people who are capable of performing what you want them to do, learning to do it and doing it, you can't compensate for incompetence. You get too many opportunities to show it. So you got to be able to do it.
I think that among the audience, we might have some who are in volunteer departments who may find themselves currently being challenged with recruitment and retention in their fire department. And one of the things that I observe as I travel around and talk with people is they get lulled into this belief that if they're short on people, they just need people. And if you hire just anybody, you'll get just anybody. And for those who've been in leadership positions, you know when you hire somebody, when you hire the wrong person, you're going to have them for a long time, and they're going to be the basis of a whole lot of pain for you over a long period of time. And it almost sounds like an oxymoron, but one of the things I tell leaders of volunteer departments is when you're running short on people and you're being challenged, raise your standards so that you're more selective about who you take onto the department. Because I'd rather have one really good attitude, nose to the grindstone, hard worker, than five mediocre people who come into the organization and stir it up and cause problems. Give me that one good attitude, hard worker every time. So look at your value systems when you're bringing these people on. You know, make sure they're bringing into the organization the kind of person that you want to have in that role. And if you've got to turn five down just to hire one, that's what I tell you to do, because that one will be a golden star versus having, you know, five things circling in the toilet bowl. Got a question from the audience.
Just to follow up on the values and attitude, I think you're exactly right. But how do you get to that point? What's the question you ask when you're talking to people without knowing the people beforehand? You know, how do you get to the point where you know their attitude and values? Is there a system out there? I mean,
well, when you're having that interview, when you're talking to a prospective, you know, employee or a volunteer firefighter, The question is not going to be about firefighting. The question is going to be about, how long have you lived in town here? And, how's your family, mom and dad, what do? Do they work in town? Where have you worked before this? And, why'd you work there? Did you find it helpful to work at that place? And what'd you like best about it? What'd you like most about it? And who do you know here in town? Who do you think in this little town that we live in is probably the most prominent person? Or do you donate any time? Do you volunteer time to the hospital? Or involved in Boy Scouts, or all those positive things, for crying out loud. You just go buy a 1950s Life magazine and look through it, and that's all right. The stuff that you're looking for, you know?
This Dennis Compton, before you leave, there's been a lot of work done on that. And a lot of it, just as John just said, is around the way questions and processes are structured. And when someone comes in and says, the reason I want to be a firefighter is because I want to help people. In other words, I want to be involved in my community. Well, the next question ought to be, give me some examples of how you've already been involved in the community. Give me some examples of how you've already helped people. When you talk to references, ask them for examples of times when you saw compassion out of that person. In other words, give me an example of it, to where you start getting at the root of that person's behavior, attitude, and approach to other people. Because that's really what we're doing. We're bringing in people to do pretty hard work at times, but basically we're in a people business. We deal with people's issues at a time when they are very vulnerable. I mean, they're having a bad day, or they wouldn't have called us. That's not a good time for them. And they don't need our bad day. They've got one.
Right.
So I think that the what we owe that system is to bring people in who are capable of performing in that role over the long haul, because they don't go away. They stay. So over the long haul, and I think that it might be helpful if you looked at some of the approaches that are used, including psychological evaluations of people. You know, I don't know how far you go with the selection process, but there are a lot of organizations that spend a lot of time looking at that issue that you bring up.
John Salk, again, is one thing that Dennis just mentioned that was, I think, very valuable. And for those of you that are ever in a position where you're inquiring or making decisions about bringing new people on, is that reference thing. You know, I've been listed as a reference on, I don't want to say an awful lot of people, but, you know, some of my friends over the years have listed me as a reference for this and for that. And that was some of the most, I don't want to say difficult, but challenging, you know, getting a phone call from somebody saying, hi, this is Bill from, you know, so-and-so company, and we have this guy's application, and he listed you as a reference. You know him for 10 years. You worked with him. And they start asking you questions about a guy or about a gal that you know that put you down as a reference. And suddenly you really do realize how much you know them and how much you have some insight into their personality and what the values and what their strengths are and things of that nature. These people ask me awful, not difficult, but pointed questions. And it was I don't want to say difficult, because difficult sounds like it was hard to do, but it was challenging to answer those questions. And you can't answer them. I don't know if you've ever been a reference for anybody, but you can't answer them in any way but honestly, you know. And it just comes right out that they're a great source. If you're looking for a job, pick your references carefully. Make sure they're people that really know you. And if you're answering, you know, if you are a reference for somebody, that's a big challenge.
I think another thing to make it a cycle of good attitudes coming through an organization and maintaining an attitude for 30 years is to have an organization that those good attitudes want to be part of. That there's something special that they want to be part of. So I think the leaders of the organization have to make sure that they're maintaining and creating an organization and fostering and whatever it takes to make sure that you've got an organization. I mean, you're already a firefighter, so that, you know, everybody in this room loves that distinction, that identification. But everybody's from different organizations of different sizes and from a super tanker to a speedboat, you know, that it's how do you create, and you gentlemen work for organizations that people want to be associated with and identified with. Just look at all the people that wear FDNY shirts that don't live in New York. coming from the Phoenix Fire Department in Mesa, it's just, you know, how do you create that image of an organization and all the things that are associated with it that people want to be part of?
Following up on what the panel had to say, one of the things that Chief Compton had said about psychological evaluations, we do psychological evaluations, but we're not sending them for a psychological evaluation to determine if they're crazy. You got to be a little bit crazy to do this job anyhow. When we meet with our psychologists, when we were hiring them, the psychologist asks us some specific questions about what we're looking for in a candidate. And that's when we pulled out our core values of our organization and said, we're looking for good attitudes, honest, hardworking, team player, good communication skills. And these are the things that the psychologist looks for in the candidate. They're not looking to see if they're, you know, head screwed on, right? I'm sure that's part of it. But when they come back and they tell us a not recommend, they're telling us they're not recommend because they don't play well in the sandbox with others. And the psychologist is able to ask them questions that we are not legally allowed to ask. You know, we can't ask you questions in an interview about, you know, how your mommy and daddy treated you when you were a child. You know, that's not directly employment related, and they could have a claim, but the psychologist can get down and dirty and under their skin and find out if there's deep-seated issues and challenges that are going to come to the surface. You know, when I have an employee that they recommend to hire, and that employee comes to work, and after a while, maybe they go a little bit off kilter, I pull out the psychological report, and it is absolutely amazing how many times the psychologist said in the report, this person might have a tendency on occasion under stress to do this or to do that. And there it is. We're seeing it. So they really do help us to determine in a very deeper level these core values that the person has, because we can be fooled in an interview. I'd like to think I'm a pretty good interviewer, but I can tell you that I've been fooled too. The second thing was what Chief Salka said about references. Here's a trick I'll give you that I had learned along the way that is very helpful with references. Typically, a person will list the references that they know are going to say something good about them. Otherwise, it'd be maybe kind of foolish to list somebody that you know is going to say something bad about you. So when you call the references and you're talking to the references and you're going through the questions with that reference, ask that reference, do you know three other people who might know this candidate maybe as well as you do that we could talk to? Maybe give us their name and their phone number. And that reference might say, oh, yeah, you know, so-and-so is a coworker and so-and-so is, you know, they go to church with. Then when you talk to those three other people, you might get a different assessment because these aren't the people who were handpicked by the candidate to talk to you about prospective employment. And the third thing that I think helps, and I'm going to turn it back to the panel maybe for a little confirmation or rebuttal, but the third thing I think that helps is inviting them in to do a ride-along because they don't have their interview guard up. You know, they're not expecting to be asked those, you know, tough interview questions, and they don't have, you know, maybe a facade on. You invite them in to do a ride-along for a shift or come to a training program or come to a social event of the department and have your people interact with them. And then ask your people, so what'd you think? You know, what'd you think about what they had to say or the way they behaved? Or, you know, if they saw a, you know, a paper towel on the floor, did they walk over it or pick it up? Yeah, and that tells you something about someone, you know, that when you guys were out doing the truck checks, did they come out and help you or did they just come out and stand there and watch, you know? And there's just certain things, behaviors that will come to the surface as they're doing this ride-along, you know, and it's all fair. You know, it's fair to consider that part of the evaluation. I'll turn it back to the panel.
When I was with Phoenix, the true story too, I sent a guy for a psychological exam, a captain, and told him he couldn't come back to work until he had some kind of a letter from a doctor indicating that he was psychologically capable to do his job. So he came back to see me in about a month. He had a letter that said he was, turned it into me, and then asked me if I had one. True story. I couldn't help but just laugh at him.
You, Mark Emery again, you mentioned about a paper towel, whether somebody's going to pick it up or walk by it, leave it for somebody else. That paper towel can tell you a lot about character and attitude. But to me, one of the best ways to tell the leadership within a fire station, because sometimes a single fire station can be something that you mentioned, nobody wants to work with that leader, that officer. Well, that means they don't want to work in that fire station. People probably can't even get trades with firefighters in that fire station because nobody wants to work with the guy that's in charge of that shift in that station. And it's, you know, how do you create a fire station culture where the attitude in that station is good, where you want to be part of that fire station? Not just the fire department, but within the fire department. Boy, people want to work for that officer at that station. You were along with that. So even a station can have its own culture and its own attitude and its own values. And I think one of the best ways to do it is call the fire station and then see how they answer the telephone. And if the tire shop down the street doesn't answer the telephone, answers the telephone more professionally than your fire station, then there's a lot of levels of problems there. There's evidence of lack of leadership in that fire station.
Okay.
You know, one other thing, Rich, this Dennis Compton, that we haven't mentioned yet that we probably should, is in volunteer departments as well as in paid departments, quite often there's a probationary period in the hiring and selection process. And I would really encourage us to use that probationary period. And there's a reason that it's there. The selection process is not perfect. It's a predictor of future performance and behavior. And the organizations that don't use that probationary process would allow people who are struggling in one way or another to complete that probationary period. It becomes much more difficult to deal with them. So if we have those in our systems, we should use them. And I don't mean that in an in-your-face kind of way, but that's what they're there for. They're a period of time to evaluate a person who's supposed to have their best foot forward. And I've seen times where if that was their best foot, I didn't want to see the rest of it.
I've heard a saying that says a broom never sweeps as clean as the day that you buy it. And from every day thereon, it'll sweep a little less clean. So if you're hiring somebody into the department that you're not seeing their best performance early on, it's probably not going to get better. At least as far as attitude and such goes, it probably isn't going to get better.
Mark Emery again, if I can add one thing.
Sure.
How often have you ever seen a fire station where a probationary firefighter comes in for their year of probation, whatever your period is, and boy, they are enthusiastic. They're going to be the most loyal and cooperative employee you're ever going to see in that employee's life. They're the hardest worker. They're ready to come to work, cooperative, loyal. They're enthusiastic, and the culture in that fire station crushes that guy. They extinguish that enthusiasm. They crush that loyalty by sitting around the beanery bitching about people that aren't there, rather than training, right, getting that guy prepared. And if he's working hard, they say, hey, what are you working so hard for? Are you trying to make us look bad? They absolutely crush that. And how do you – and imagine if you flip that around, where the guy comes into the fire station with that enthusiasm and that loyalty and that desire to work hard, and it matches up and dovetails with what's going on in that fire station and in the fire department. So you can come in as a probationary firefighter and have that absolutely crushed and destroyed by one fire station and one shift and one crew.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be addressing some additional firehouse management questions with Chief Dennis Compton, Chief Mark Emery, and Chief John Salka.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Firehouse Management Podcast at the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore with Chief Dennis Compton, Chief Mark Emery, and Chief John Salka. We do have one question from the audience, so I'll ask the person with the question to please come up to the podium and ask your question for the Chiefs.
First of all, I'd like to make a comment. I'm sure there's a lot of people out in the audience around the country when they heard that service and values was more important than actually the tactical firefighting capabilities is scaring, but it is the reality of the future. All of the things that you've discussed today are I've seen in my 31 years as being valid. And I think my perception is safety issue. I didn't pay too much attention to it to the last 3 years. And now going to the National Fallen Firefighters Memorial every year to work and see the faces of the families who actually lose the firefighters and have to live with it every day, the safety issue is a major issue. Our change in a culture. I talk to people all the time, and we're talking a good talk, but we're not going anywhere. How are we really in the fire service going to change the safety culture? We had a firefighter today from U.S. Fire Administration, 24 years old, died in a collapse of an unoccupied building. Two other firefighters die. We're not touching the issue the way we should be.
Well, Tony, John Salka speaking. The one point that I've been bringing up a lot lately, and I know Dennis does and Mark and lots of other people out there at different organizations and magazines and programs, is I think, and we've all recognized, certainly just pick up a magazine, pick up Firehouse Magazine, there's two or three articles on leadership. Now, tactics are important, but it comes down to leadership. We just had this discussion in the van yesterday coming back from a hands-on training. A couple of guys in my van are FDNY retired guys or active guys, and the seatbelt issue came up because a couple of us put our seatbelts on in the van as soon as we left, and a couple guys didn't. And somebody said, gee, this is interesting. Look at this, how some guys are wearing a seatbelt and some guys are not. And somebody mentioned something about the seatbelt pledge, and one of my guys sitting in the back seat said, oh, what a bunch of crap. The seatbelt pledge. He said it has nothing to do with a pledge. It has nothing to do with seatbelts. If the guy in the front seat, that's the officer, wants everybody to wear the seatbelt, and he's influential, and he's a good leader, and he's positive, and he has great values, they're all going to be wearing a seatbelt. If it's the officer's priority, then it will be the crew's priority. All the stuff we talked about earlier in these earlier questions. I go anywhere with that guy. That includes wearing a seatbelt. That includes driving safely. That includes wearing your SCBA. That includes, you know, doing risk versus reward before you go out on that roof or before you go into that building. So all of our tactical things, all of our tactical abilities and skills and safety skills, all of them are so dramatically affected by by our leadership skills and how well we are able. Those of you that are bosses that are listening, if you're a chief or a company officer, it's your leadership skills that are going to guide and influence all the other aspects of your command. The good bosses have well-run firehouses. The firehouse runs well. I don't know how good they do with fires, but if he runs the firehouse well, he probably runs the fires well. So it's not one-dimensional. It's multidimensional, but the one thing that affects everything is the leadership. And I think that we're on the right road in the fire service, stressing that and paying a lot more attention to the quality of the leadership in the fire service.
I Mark Emery again. How many people out there just take an informal survey, invest as much time and energy preparing somebody to be a fire officer, to be a fire officer, as you invest in preparing somebody off the street to be a firefighter? Or you've got a formal, let's say you got a 10-week recruit academy, you got a 10-week officer development academy.
Very few.
Very few. What if we invested that much time and energy in officer development as we do in entry-level firefighter development? I believe that would produce such a huge benefit to your leadership and to your fire officers and the cultures and fire stations, if we would do that. And a lot of times the guy that gets the red helmet or the orange helmet is the guy that has the best test day. Not necessarily the best guy on that day or in the fire department for that promotion. It's the guy that has the best test. And then how many people to pick your officers bring perfect strangers in as assessors and assessment centers to evaluate those guys that are going to be your leaders. And they look at them for maybe 15 or 20 minutes in an assessment center. And then next guy comes in, and you do end up with strangers picking your fire officers and your leaders. How ridiculous is that?
This is Dennis Compton. I had the opportunity to facilitate both of the national summits concerning firefighter line of duty deaths. And there were a lot of capable people there who have been involved in the issue a long time. We separated those people at the first summit into six groups. Okay, the only initiative that emerged from all six groups independently, the only one, independently, they didn't discuss it with each other first, was the topic that we're on right now, and essentially the subject of your question, is this issue of leadership, and that if we can't shift the leadership and supervisory element of our system, you're not going to reach those goals, is essentially what they're saying. And I think that what we all struggle with up here, and you probably struggle with it out there, I know every day I think about it, is how do you reach the point in the fire service where the decisions are being made, in other words, where the leader is acting out, where the firefighter is acting and behaving a certain way. In other words, that touch, that place where it's happening. You know, there's a lot to do regarding the management of the fire service, regarding safety culture. But where we're really struggling is the ability to touch and change the behavior of people who make the decisions where things happen. And that's I think that is a significant challenge for all of us. Because you can take the efforts that are going on right now, and they're wonderful. I commend all the fire service organizations that are involved. In my career, I have never read more articles, watched more presentations, including from the people who are sitting up here on this panel, where they talk about a concern for the safety of firefighters and a concern about line-of-duty deaths. In my whole career, I've never seen so much of it. So there's a lot of effort going on there. But I think we're struggling reaching that point. And we're going to just continue at it. What I would like to see done, to answer your question, is to solicit more of the fire organizations themselves to take ownership of some of the issues. I think they want to, and I think we should encourage that. There are some excellent opportunities there to do that. But if you look at the issue of cardiac and stroke, vehicles, strategy, and crew integrity, about 90% of our fatalities every year fall into those four areas. And I think the greatest example of leadership I've seen in a long time, was very recent, and it was communicated to me about a month and a half ago, that there's a captain in a fire department, a rather large fire department, who has been a captain about 5 years and has a reputation for pushing his drivers to drive faster, outside the regulations, trying to beat others into their first two areas and make sure no one beats them into their calls. But it's a dirty little secret. No one ever talks about it on the fire department, but people know about it, okay? Well, one day he gets this guy that's been an engineer for about 20 years and drives at the central station in the city, and he's working an overtime shift on this guy's truck. And they're on their way to a fire call, and this guy starts in on him. Come on, come on, come on, get going, get going, get going. Engineer pulls the truck over to the side of the road, says, you want to drive this damn thing? You want me to? Doesn't make any difference to me. That was leadership. And that captain was stuck. There ain't no way to take that. There's nowhere to take that. And there were two people on the truck that heard it, and that's how it got out. And it's nobody's little secret anymore either. No, and he's not doing it anymore either. So to some extent, you know, that happened at the point of contact. In other words, that happened at the point where something was occurring, and it was somebody who simply had the confidence, the capability, and the personal skills to do it.
And a great lesson about that, and what Mark said, this is John Salka again, just a few minutes ago, was, and I'll ask this sort of in the form of a question, who runs the fire department? Who runs your fire department? From the perspective of what happens out in the street. You know, certainly there are people that run my fire department. We have all sorts of people, you know, chief of training and chief of operations and chief of department. And there are all sorts of people at headquarters in my fire department. And headquarters is a building far, far away from my firehouse. Right? I'm not saying it'll impact us. But who do you think the firefighters, the young men in my firehouse, who do you think they are most influenced by? By their company officers. Not by me, up in the battalion office, by their company officers. Company officers run the fire department. You know, I don't mean that literally, but they certainly run what the firefighters think and what a company officer's priority is, whether it's this fella driving fast, pushing his guys to drive fast, or whether it's some really positive guy that talks about safety or talks about doing things properly. It's the company officer. So you're right. It's that company officer role. You got to look back. How are you preparing your company officers? You know, in New York State, New York City is part of New York State. We're fortunate that we have a first-line supervisors program that runs right at our New York City Fire Academy, but it's a great program. Been in business for a long time. I'm an officer a long time, and I went there, you know, when I was promoted. And there are some places that just give you a new shirt, a new color shirt, and a lieutenant's bar, and tell you to go to Engine 3 instead of Ladder 1. And that's where you go start beeping the horn. Now, a lot of great officers have been produced all over the country by doing that. You know, some great guys that are great officers and great chiefs today that never had any formal training. But it was pretty random. You know, they luckily developed well, probably by virtue of the people that they worked with that had some good skills. But we should be putting some real time into that. I apologize, I didn't turn that off.
You know, this Dennis Gompers, I have one more thing to comment on about that. Your comment about values being more important than the capability to do the job, I certainly didn't say that, and I don't think anybody meant it that way. Yeah. What I meant when I talked about it was that you got to have people who are capable of doing what you want them to do. I mean, you got to hire people who are capable of doing the job, but also that have values that are consistent with your organization. In other words, that if their values don't match what you're looking for or what you need in an individual, hire someone else who's capable of doing the job that does match, is my point. I'm not saying you hire incompetent people who have good attitudes. I'm talking about both of them being important and critical, and don't do one without the other.
I picked up on that too, Denny, right up front where you had said that, Tony. And what came to my mind was, and thanks for clarifying it, Chief Compton, is what we're trying to do is hire the people who have the right attitude, and with the right attitude, they become exponentially trainable. You know, I would imagine that all of us have seen people in fire departments who have 1 year of experience repeated 20 times. When you have a trainable person, you can take a person in their first year, and in their first year, they can get 5 years of experience because they're continually going to school, learning. They're taking classes. They're reading the journals. You know, they're accelerating their learning ability through their good attitude. And you have somebody who has a bad attitude, and you go into the station, they're not reading Firehouse Magazine, they're reading Field and Stream. You know, and the person who has the right attitude is going to say, every moment that I'm here is an opportunity for me to learn something and to be better at my job. And that's what we're trying to promote you to look for those people versus the one who says, okay, I got the job. Now it's time to, you know, kick the Barca Lounger back and watch ESPN.
John Salk, again, I'd like to add one more observation on this, and that is, you know, a lot of departments are not, you know, really in control because of civil service systems and laws and test procedures. A lot of times just a whole bunch of people get hired into a department, and you don't get what you get, but certainly you hope the right people are attracted and things of that nature. But what ends up happening is then it's the firehouse attitude, and it's the values and the way that people are treated inside the firehouse that suddenly an outsider comes in, a guy who was delivering mail or flipping hamburgers until last year, suddenly he's in the fire department, knows little about it. Maybe his uncle was one, or maybe he lived on the same block as a firehouse. And within a year, at least I can tell you how it is in my job, the firehouse atmosphere is so positive and so nurturing. And I don't mean nurturing, mommy, baby nurturing. I mean young fire comes in there. He doesn't know. A year later, he knows. He knows what's right. He knows what's wrong. And he's doing it. And he's living it. And 2 years later, he's the guy helping to teach the new guy that comes in 2 years later. And that has been sustained from my career and long before me and hopefully long after me, the positive attitude and atmosphere inside the fire station that's produced by the company officers and the chiefs and the firefighters. Firefighters are a larger part of that than anybody. That sometimes can bring people over and they can learn. They can learn new values and learn new priorities and things of that nature. It's a very good thing to think about.
Thanks, Tony. Do you have another question or a follow-up?
Yeah, it goes back to the beginning of the people we bring in, and I know you addressed this somewhat. And I got to give an explanation. We all know that a lot of firefighters join, that they're there to do the tactical things. They're cool. My 22-year-old, he's learning that maybe he needs to learn some people skills. He had a couple interviews that didn't go so well, and he communicated that to me the last 2 days. But the point is, how do we get out to the people that we're looking for, that we're looking more for people. You have to have good tactical skills. You got to have good. But as Dennis said in his previous discussion, attitude is not something that we come in a fire department and say, here's your attitude. You'll now have for the next 30 years. It's got to be built. So we need to get that message out. Look at this room. There's not a whole lot of young guys going, I got to learn what it's like. This doesn't say fire chief management, it said fire department management. They should be in here because they're the critical link. And the complaint we always have is personnel issues. So how do we start getting them to understand that we're starting to change our paradigm? We're not looking for you just to be able to be the best firefighter, because that's probably what's sometimes getting people killed, is how you use the balance. And a lot of it's how you use your brain. And being a paramedic, 90% of my job is empathy, not saving a life. And when Mrs. Jones writes a letter, it's not how well I treated her. And it's getting more and more in the fire service that more of the stuff we do when we go out on the street is not tactical. It's interacting with Mrs. Jones, and your smoke detector didn't work, and here's how we're going to help you. And I just think that's a key issue. But the points you all brought up are absolutely what the rest of the fire service needs to look at.
What do you all think about that in a fire department, that the officer development starts in recruit school, in probationary firefighter training? Entry-level firefighter training is also where officer development starts. So if they're thinking about at a tactical level, not only do they know how to extend that hose line and they can operate the nozzle and they can advance that nozzle and they can have the water mingle with the heat, but you start the officer development attitude of, well, don't rush in there. Let's look around right now. What do you see outside here? Did you check the windows? Are you sure? You know, what if there's a basement? Do you want to be going in here? If there was a basement, the expectation should be that your officer has done a size up and knows if there is a basement, there's not going to be fire underneath you. Not only is that guy going to learn how to actually, he is actually going to physically take the hose line in the building and squirt the water, but you're starting the thought process of look around. You know, when you enter and if you're going to go up the stairs, check the first. Don't get focused on going up the stairs, moth to flame. But as you're going up the stairs, look around floor one. Make sure you're not going to end up with fire below you. You know, those kind of attitudes,
which not technically officer development, but you're developing those attitudes and things that when they become an officer, I really believe those emotional experiences you get in recruit school are those same are going to be the things that that fire officer exhibits. And if it's just blast through the door and get that line to the fire and don't think, don't look, when that's a significant emotional event when you're a rookie firefighter. And when you become an officer, that significant event is you're going to do the exact same thing as a fire officer.
Well, I know we've agreed on a lot of things, but I got to draw a line there. Now, you're a bright guy, and I'm sure some of your concept there is valid, but I disagree. And I disagree for this reason. Recruit school is for recruits. And I don't know how long you got to work in your fire department before you become a good fireman or a good firefighter. That's a bit of a compliment to my job to be called a good fireman. You got to work years in my job. Years to become a good fireman. It just starts in probie school. Just starts. That's just where the task level stuff starts, and maybe some tactical ideas. And gosh, those guys are centuries away from even thinking about being an officer in my fire department. I realize we're in a younger age now, and guys and gals are getting into the officer ranks earlier. But I think there is so much to know, technical and tactical information, as a firefighter. Working firefighter, that I couldn't even consider breaking new ground and adding new concepts of strategy. And now the thinking part is important. Yeah, guys should be knowing why they're doing things rather than just what to do. You should know why you're doing it as well. But I still think that's all part of firefighter training and recruit training and entry-level training. And working firefighter has to spend so much time learning everything. Gosh, it's expanded in the past couple of years from, you know, obviously firefighting and emergencies and gas leaks and emergency medical and confined space and hazmat, and it just goes on and on and on. There are so many things that an ordinary firefighter getting the back off an engine or a truck has to know. Never mind, you just go to my job, I got a pile of books like this on all the different positions and first do, second do, roof man. These guys study for years. I mean, even if you're going to study for lieutenant, it would take you years to study those concepts. But they study for years just to be a good fireman or a good firefighter. So I'm not really disagreeing in a big way, but I think some of those concepts that you're thinking about, it's not officer school. I know guys that are firefighters for 20 years, and all I can say is thank God. Thank God for senior, well-trained firefighters that aren't aspiring to be officers. That's an important part of the fire department. It's not all about officers. I'm sort of contradicting what I said a few minutes ago about them being a very important part of the job, company officers, but nobody's as important in a fire than a nozzle man, you know, and the irons guy that's going to take the door. So,
This is Mark again. I got to tell you, I agree with what you disagreed with that I said. and I wasn't saying that you actually start officer development.
Okay.
So, boy, that I want to clear that. It's that you start the attitudes that they're going to need as a fire officer.
I agree.
Okay. There we go.
Okay. Thanks, Tony. Again, if somebody from the audience has a question, please feel free to come up to the front chair. The next question, we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit off of personnel and hiring and development, and take a question from a podcast listener who had written in to firehouse.com. And this one is probably one that is a question very pertinent to the times that we live in now. It's been reported that economic challenges are causing many cities to experience budget shortfalls, leading to projected reductions in all service areas. What recommendations would you make for leading your fire department that may be facing a substantial budget reduction?
Well, this is Dennis Compton. I'll take a shot at that, since all of us up here have managed this at one time or another in organizations. You know, there is no easy way to get through difficult financial times in government. And I think, too, that if we look back historically, those times cycle. And so during a career, you're going to manage times of reduced revenue. It's just simply going to happen. There are some things I think you can do as an organization up front that puts you in a better position to deal with those. Okay, because I don't think that it's ever easy when you start about when you start talking about taking away. It's never easy when you start talking about shutting down or browning out areas of a city. It's never easy when you start talking about cutting your ability to support a response system or to provide prevention and public education services because of budget shortfalls. That's never easy. There are people with real names and real families involved in those decisions. But there are some things that the organization could have done often up front that would minimize the impact of this and improve your chances of getting through them as intact as possible. One of them is to improve labor relations. That quite often we're vulnerable as fire departments because we are vulnerable because we don't get along inside the system. We've got problems with each other going in. In fact, I've often said that if I wanted to screw with a fire department and I was a manager outside of it, the first thing I would do is figure out some way to get them fighting with each other and then leave for about 6 months and come back and then do whatever it was I was going to do. So the first thing is to try to have communications between labor and management or the workers and the chiefs, even in volunteer organizations, where there's open communications. There is the ability to sit down and talk about the problems and strategies to help get through them. The other is good relations with elected officials. One of the things that I've seen fire chiefs who were very capable politically and union presidents who were very capable politically and employee officials and volunteer officials who were very influential politically is that they had those connections up front. So I don't know how much pain there was going to be in the process, but the pain was going to be equally spread. In other words, the fire department was not going to be an unfair victim of what occurred, that they were going to get a shot at the process because of the relationships they had with the policymakers ahead of time. And then I've also seen fire departments that were a pain in the rear end, not only inside the system but outside the system. They had bad relationships, and the budget process was used as a way to punish them. Okay, so both of those things. The other thing that I did several times, and I would do again if I had the opportunity, is once you get into the process and you've lost some of the revenue, and it's hard to buy new things, and it's hard to do much with capital equipment and whatnot for a couple of years, moving the focus to internally. In other words, it gives us time to work on those books John was talking about this tall, because now there's less innovation, perhaps. There's less new that we're buying. There's less something that we're opening. There's perhaps less people that we're hiring. And it gives us an opportunity to get our SOPs and SOGs straightened out, gives us an opportunity to work on internal relations and things that build that organization from the standpoint of leadership, training. In other words, those kinds of things. And then the last thing I would say is that if you're going to promote to a position of management or leadership in the fire department, anticipate economic cycles. And if you have an opportunity to do a multiple-year plan to work your way through it, try to encourage them to let you do that. Because if it's a year-by-year process, most of those don't turn around in a single year. So there's going to be round two, and there's going to be round three. And you're a lot better off if you've anticipated those up front.
John Salka again. I've never been a staff chief. I've never been a chief of department or anybody in a position. I've pretty much always in my career been on the receiving end of budgets, as I imagine many of you are. And the one thing that I experienced, and it's a single story of a single day and a single comment, not many years ago, but a bunch of years ago. I was a young firefighter waiting to be promoted to lieutenant. Guy in my study group, Billy Moore, was a lieutenant getting promoted to captain, and he was in my study group. A bunch of us used to study together for promotion, and we all would go to each other's promotions, and we went to Bill Moore's promotions. And it was around the time in New York City, and you may not even remember it, but Ed Kochan was the mayor at the time, and he closed the fire company during the Super Bowl. It was a big, big issue. They relocated the company, and when they got to where they were relocating to, thinking there was something going on, they were told their company has been closed for the day. It was quite a disastrous situation politically, and the fire department was up in arms, and it was just a terrible time in the fire department. But the day of the promotion, the assistant chief that was the acting chief of the department at the time stood up, Lou Harris, pretty senior fellow at the time, and he congratulated everybody on their promotion. There were some lieutenants and some captains and battalion chiefs, and he said, you know what? He said, it's been tough times in the FDNY lately. He said, I know a lot of guys don't feel good about the job, about what happened and the closing of the company and the way that we did it. And there was a march across the Brooklyn Bridge with banners and stuff. It was just terrible. He said, I've lived through a lot of bad times. I was through the fire department during wars and during fiscal crises and during terrible closing of companies. And he said, and what got me through and what I'm telling you, advice for you today is and it sort of reflects what Dennis just said. He said, just pay attention to where you're at. You know, focus your energies on your company. You guys are the new lieutenants, worry about your shift. The guys that you work with, the five or six firefighters that are on duty with you when you're in the company, make sure there's good training. Make sure the firehouse atmosphere is positive. Make sure the guys are learning and being safe. You captains that are getting promoted to captain, pay attention to your new command. Now you're company commanders. You have a couple of lieutenants to supervise along with 25 firefighters, not just your shift. Pay attention to you having a good, positive environment in the firehouse. And those of you making battalion chief, he made the same point. Worry about your battalion. He said, I don't want any of you to worry about the FDNY. Don't worry about what's going on between us and City Hall. Don't worry about the fact that they're closing companies. He said, worry about your company. And I got to tell you, I was livid. I was angry about that speech. I said, how dare this guy tell us to not pay attention to what's happening to our fire department? And now, about 18 or 20 years later, I've discovered that he was right. He was right. That was some of the most valuable advice I've ever gotten in the fire department. When things are going bad, just bring your focus down a little bit to the stuff that you're in charge of, to the stuff that you can change and you can maintain. I've been to firehouses in my travels around the country training. I've been to firehouses that didn't have squat. They had 23-year-old apparatus that were rusting out. They had turnout gear that they had to sew themselves together down the block at the guy that made the upholstery shop. They had tools that were, you know, bent and bangled a little bit, but there was no money for anything new. And they were some of the happiest, most productive firehouses I've ever been in because they did a little bit of work. The company officers came in early. The firefighters loved to train, and they just brought their focus down in on themselves, on their company or their department, I mean, the unit or their battalion. And I think that's very good advice. In times of fiscal strife, when companies are being closed, and I've heard some stories here, just a couple of days I've been here, places that are in the process of closing companies and more next year. And you know what? The best thing you could do there is, obviously, if you're at the top, like Dennis was and like some other people are, there's things you can do. But as a company officer or a chief officer in a field-level officer, just bring your focus back into your own company and pay attention to what's going on. Keep that place afloat for a couple of years until the tide turns and things start to get a little bit better.
Absolutely. This is Dennis Compton. One thing I would add to that is that I'm always proud of the firefighters. I truly am. But one of the most prideful times for me was during very difficult budget times. And it was while I was in Phoenix. And we were going through a horrible reduction in revenue in the city. In fact, we had a recruit class in that had 30 people in it that were going to get laid off the day they graduated. Okay? And the union and the chiefs, we put together a plan together as a labor management group, sold it to the city, and all of us voted as a chiefs group and as a union. Only 3 people voted against it total in the fire department. And we all took 2 shifts off without pay so that those kids didn't lose their jobs. That is a great example of sacrifice to get through difficult times. That was a 1-year fix, and we had to figure out what the next one looked like. But the next one, we didn't have that many young people who were going to lose their jobs. And I was proud of it. I really was. It was a unique way to get through a very difficult time. And you wouldn't believe, just like John said just a second ago, how much camaraderie that caused inside the fire department. Is it in a very difficult time when you would think we'd all be angry about what was happening, and instead we felt good about what we had done for each other.
Nice.
And went on to paradise. You know?
Pretty unselfish.
I think when you're faced with a situation like the question describes, you can either look at it logically or emotionally. And I think it's very easy to make it emotional and make it personal and look for blame. But I think the sooner you, as Chief Compton shared, the sooner you can get your staff engaged in some solution-oriented discussions, because that's where you're going to be productive. It's not productive to sit around and complain about the economic times or the way City Hall is treating the fire department. You're not going to change that by complaining, but to be solution-oriented and bring the players together and say, what's the good news in this? Where's the opportunity for us? How can we weather this storm together as an organization and come out stronger? I heard a saying that kind of popped in my mind as the Chiefs were talking here, that I heard somebody say once that they said, when you're going through hell, don't stop to take pictures. And what they meant by that was, you're going to go through tough times, but don't dwell there. Find a way to get through it and move on and continue to be a productive organization. Don't spend a lot of time wallowing in the pain of the situation that you're dealing with, but find a way to get past that and move on and continue to be productive as an organization. I'm going to give each of the chiefs an opportunity to make some closing comments, and then we'll bring an end to our Firehouse Management podcast. Chief Emery?
I just would like to thank Pete and Firehouse for the opportunity to do this. I really feel fortunate that I'm able to sit here with Chief Salka and Chief Compton and this group. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I won't add anything to the management thing other than to say thank you very much. Pleasure
great,
to be here.
Great. This is John Salka. I think the whole point here between this podcast and many of the others, and certainly we're here at the Baltimore Expo, it's about training. You know, it's about training. That's what this is all about. And I talk about training a lot. I travel around a lot doing it, as all of us up here do. And it doesn't matter if you have money, and it doesn't matter if you volunteer, and it doesn't matter if your career, and nothing matters with training. There's plenty of stuff to do in a firehouse any night of the week, any afternoon. You can stop in, open up a compartment, and look at a tool and do some training on it. The training opportunities are limitless. I almost flip out when I hear people standing around a firehouse saying, gee, we can't think of what to train on, because I could talk for an hour just listing subjects that you could train on. And so training is the priority. With leadership is important, and company officers is important, and all that other stuff, everything is important. But the thing that we're most in control of every day, and it's going to keep you safe and alive and effective, is doing some good training on a pretty regular basis. You don't have to do it 23 hours a day. But I tell any career officer, and volunteers as well, but career officers even more pointedly, every time you work, if you're not doing training, you're not doing your job. If you're not doing some training every time you're in the firehouse, you're not doing your job. And everybody benefits by that, so just think about that.
Yeah, this is Dennis Compton. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today as well. This subject of leadership is, as we said earlier today, is probably leadership, supervision, management. I have a hard time separating those three. And together, they are so important to the bottom line, which is the mission of the organization. We simply can't be effective as organizations without capable leaders in that process somewhere, at various levels, in fact. And the challenge that we have, I think, is not to be positive, productive, and healthy in that role just the day or the year or 2 years after you get that job, but over the long haul, because we tend to stay so doggone long in the fire service. In other words, we stay 20, 25, 30, 35 years. And I think the real challenge for us is to keep ourselves that way throughout our careers. I've been to retirement parties before where I couldn't tell who the party was for, the one that was leaving or the one that got to stay without them. You know, and that's a shame. I've been to lots of other retirement parties where people were truly sad to see someone go who had 30, 35, 40 years in the system, and they were truly sad to see him go. They still liked working around him. They still liked working with him. And I would leave that as our challenge, is this isn't a sprint. It's a long, long career, and the ones that are successful over the long haul are the ones I tend to admire the most. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Firehouse.com for hosting this, and Peter Matthews, the editor, that arranged to have the panel together. I'd like to thank the panel for the gift of their time and sharing their expertise. Thank you to the audience, the live audience, who gave your time to come and be a part of the program today. And then finally to the podcast listeners who tune in regularly to the various programs sponsored on Firehouse.com. This concludes the Firehouse Management Podcast at the Firehouse Expo.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.